The world is changing at breathtaking speeds, with trends and fads popping up and passing away at breakneck pace. Against that backdrop of nearly constant upheaval, we welcome you to the Sunday Scotch Society. Over delectable, sumptuous scotches and with the occasional good cigar in hand, we have open, honest, and uninhibited conversation about whatever strikes our fancy. Whether it's the critical issue of the day or a deep dive down the rabbit hole, we take it all seriously while having a good time. Join us for a stiff drink and a great conversation. Ladies and gentlemen, boys and girls.
Germs and other biota.
Objects of celestial origin.
All the things.
Objects of infernal origin as well. Welcome to the Sunday Scotch Society.
Why, thank you. Because as you did single me out in your last little inclusion there.
Ladies and gentlemen, please note that on this occasion, I cast no aspersions. My partner in crime has chosen to self-identify in a way that I don't think any of us would.
Me and the devil.
Yeah, we don't necessarily agree, but hey, you know, in the current age, identity is what you say it is, and people are choosing to identify as whatever strikes their fancy. So, if Matthew chooses to identify as of infernal origin, then that is his choice. One of these days, I would like to talk on this this show about whether or not there are such things as absolutes. Because
short conversation.
Well, not necessarily, and I think that's part of the fun, right? Anyway, my name is K. Quincy Parker, and welcome to the Sunday Scotch Society. As I've said. My partner in crime,
Matthew B. Kelly,
the Esquire, Matthew B. Kelly, comma INF.ESQ.
You know, for just a very strange reason, my brother and I ran across the criteria for becoming a JP the other day.
Okay.
So I you know, some part of my ego is like, should do that in the next 5 years. Just have JP hanging off the end, just for kicks.
Just for kicks, okay. Well,
it of course would not be anyone in the future citing this as evidence. That is tongue-in-cheek, and I do not think that it would... That JP is worthless hanging off the end. It's not just for kicks. There are a lot of very useful things, and JPs have helped me out quite a bit in my life.
Okay.
You could leave that in or cut that out as you please,
sir.
Oh, no,
sir. I'm leaving that in, brother.
As you please.
That caveat meant that I was free to leave it in. Without the caveat, we might have had a different conversation. Anyway, I'm excited about today because we're going in very different directions today, both with the tipple and the conversation. Today's tipple is a surprise because it is not what we would normally consider here on the Sunday Scotch Society. Today, we are going to be sipping a single malt whiskey from Texas.
Stop it.
Yeah. It's by the Balcones Distillery. And they started in 2008 in Waco, Texas. And they got started distilling in 2009 with a passion to create, according to them, something original and authentic in the heart of Texas. And so, they use some of the ingredients include blue corn, grown out of New Mexico.
Okay.
Texas grown malted barley, and I'm just, well, I feel like they started something, because even with the world of whiskey out there, if you go to Texas and you talk about whiskey, the people who are whiskey drinkers will inevitably bring up, you know, oh, well, you know, we make our own whiskey here in Texas. And so there is a good chance that someone will be asking you, do you want to try a Balcones? And so today what we are going to sip is the Balcones Texas 1 single malt whiskey. It is, we've talked from time to time on the show about the relative potency of whiskey and the various sort of whiskey products, right? Traditionally, you have your Irish whiskeys that are about 40% alcohol by volume. Mm-hmm. So they're, you know, they sit around 80 proof. Your Scotch whiskeys, especially the single malt scotches, can get, you know, up to 90 proof or so, 45% ABV, maybe a little higher in some cases if it's cask strength. And in the wine world, one of the things that they talk about is that American wines tend to be far stronger in terms of alcohol by volume than wines from elsewhere, particularly old world wines. And it seems that the same is true when it comes to whiskeys. Because the Texas 1 single malt whiskey produced by Balcones sits at 53% alcohol by volume, which means that it is 106 proof.
Don't mess with Texas.
Yeah, don't mess with Texas. I kind of wanted to make sure to get that out of the way quickly, because
I mean, did we really expect anything else?
Not out of Texas, no. You know, but I don't want anyone who happens to find themselves in Texas and picks up a bottle to say, "Boy, them dudes didn't tell me this thing was this potent." And I also didn't want you, Matthew, to choke on your first sip, because I did not tell you, brace yourself, my brother.
Well, thankfully, there's the nose first, which I think.
Yeah. Well, I mean, and the thing is, you know what? We might as well get started.
Do, sir, the thing.
If I may.
Ah, yes. I'm good. Thank you.
So, in the tasting notes, well, as we would traditionally do, I'd rather get your unvarnished view of how the nose, how you find the nose on this Texas whiskey.
So, I'm wondering now if you have some Freudian / subconscious slips going on with your choice of words, saying unvarnished.
Ooh. Ooh.
Oh, no, no. Oh, that is pleasant.
Yes.
Nowhere near as alcohol forward as I thought it would be.
Not on the nose, certainly. Which is...
This amber, I have to say, is tending towards a deep, deep orange gold. So that the color on this is quite serious.
It is a...
Hmm.
What the hell?
I'm not getting a lot of notes out of it, actually. It's kind of perfumey.
Oh,
what is that?
It's floral. Your nose, bro, so you have to tell me.
Yeah, it's not... Okay, it's floral, but not in a way that I could isolate, hey, it's this flower, that flower.
I feel like you should have your own descriptors.
Yeah, well, I feel mm-hmm. that almost 80% of this journey is trying to build a vocabulary
around
this. But I was telling a friend yesterday that with a lot of the Highland scotches, I would detect a green apple.
Ah, okay.
And then another friend present was actually describing what that chemical is. But don't look at me as if I would remember exactly what he said.
Because, I mean, that's the next logical step, right?
Yeah, well, I was already a bear in and a half finger through the whiskey at that point.
I get you.
But this does not give me that, is the point.
Mm.
Hints of the candied apple, but in a very, like almost buried, layered down a few notches.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm,
mm-hmm.
It's very, you're picking up on something that they mention prominently in the tasting notes when it comes to the nose. So their tasting notes for the nose and what to expect on the nose,
mm-hmm.
it's ripe, buttered stone fruit. Stone fruit meaning, you know, any fruit that
fruits
has
with stones.
A pit, you know, like a peach or whatever okay. the case may be. They say bananas, pears, honey. And the thing that I think you're picking up on with the floral note is rose water. And they also talk about citrus accents.
Hmm, okay.
So,
very slight citrus, yeah, okay. Yeah. If you linger.
Yeah. And I feel like that's actually one of the more accurate sort of tasting note descriptions that I've come across with these whiskeys. Usually it's a little more fanciful, right? But I think this one, forgive the pun, but I think this one is right on the nose. I know. I couldn't help it.
You're very punny, sir.
I had to.
I'm a sucker for a pun, so you get no beef from me.
There are so many puns that I wish to make right now in regards to beef and being punny, but we are going to move on, or else we're going to lose track of what we're supposed to be talking about. The traditional thing to do after enjoying the nose of a fine spirit is to then move to the tasting thereof.
Put it in thine mouth.
Indeed. Brace yourself again. It's 53% ABV.
Ooh. Oh, the finish is a burn.
Mm-hmm.
Pleasant though. Mm-hmm. This is nowhere near as harsh as I thought it would be from the ABV.
Yeah.
Like I said, the nose says nothing about harshness at all. So yeah, that is interesting.
And it is strong. And I mean really strong,
mm-hmm.
without tasting too sharp.
Mm.
I imagine a cube of ice would go nicely, which this is one of the few whiskeys that I've had that I would say maybe would benefit from a cube of ice. I rather usually drink mine neat.
That's interesting. Mm-hmm. I mean, I would still take this neat. I'll try it with the cube.
Yeah, this bottle was a gift from a friend who had been at an event in Texas, and it.
I would call. Sorry. It's bright.
It is very bright.
It's bright.
Very bright.
Wakes up the palate quite a bit, and the lingering isn't heavy either. It smooth coat. It has the butterscotch feel, but not so much the taste to me.
The first thing I noticed about it the first time I tasted it was how soft and smooth it was on the tongue and lips. Mm-hmm. It wasn't until a few seconds later that the alcohol burn sort of kicked in, but the immediate feeling was of silkiness. Mm. And I was like, oh, so I had, that set me up for a particular kind of flavor experience, which the actual flavors of this Balcones Texas One Single Malt Whiskey sort of, they went in a different direction. Mm-hmm. Usually when you get a whiskey that is that smooth on the tongue right away, it develops into something really fruity or sweet or it, but this has, it has some kick.
Yeah, it does. I have to say, it does develop a very subtle sweet, but not in a sort of fruity, sickly kind of way. Mm-hmm. More like, it must be the corn, right?
Yeah, probably.
Which, again, corn, like, yeah. I don't hate bourbons. Perhaps I encountered bad bourbons early on. I don't know, but they're not like my favorite, and especially around the sweeter side of things, like not a fad. Mm-hmm. Right, I'll get some Kool-Aid if I felt like something sweet, sir. But
I think we have to bring the Widow Jane onto the show then.
So the point is that this has that very subtle sweetness. You could taste its relationship to bourbon for sure, but it doesn't feel like a bourbon to me.
Yeah, it because it's a Scotch, right? And it's
okay.
Let me get to it. It came off as flippant, but that's not what I meant. What I mean is the blending of the ingredients and the style of the distillation leads in a different direction.
Yeah.
The high percentage of corn that bourbon has to have in order to be called bourbon,
right,
is what I was talking about, right? You don't, they use blue corn in their mash, but it is at a far more restrained level than it would be if they were trying to make it sweet like a bourbon or whatever the case may be.
Yeah.
But the tasting notes from Balcones talk about a silky, full, and let's see, lightly toasted bread, they say, fresh butter, and marmalade. Those are the flavors that they experience in their own, you know.
I wouldn't disagree with all of them, but if the notes are there for me, they are, it's quite a subtle drink. Mm-hmm. Which is crazy considering the ABV.
Yeah. You would expect at least one flavor to really be punching you in the tongue. But,
right.
But it isn't. It's very well balanced for me. I drink it occasionally because it's a little stronger than my preference. But it is a distinctive Scotch that I think is definitely worth trying, especially because I think it is representative of Texas scotch. Mm. And I enjoy having a, you know, a rounded experience, the experience of whiskeys from as many different places as I can. You know, like the Japanese whiskeys are very light, very sweet, you know, very subtle kind of flavorings with a dash of smoke. The Chinese whiskeys that I have a little kind of a almost ricey flavor, which makes, you know, maybe that's racist, but it makes sense to me. Obviously, we've talked about the Irish whiskeys and the Scotch whiskeys. We've talked about bourbon, but this is the first Texas whiskey that I had, and I thought, okay, I see what you do in Texas, and for all intents and purposes, I like it.
You are approved. Okay, so I was gonna say, like, you have the privilege of tasting such a wide range of these things, and you know, by proxy, then I share that privilege. Mm-hmm. Gonna propose something on the fly. Okay. Cut it if you like. Just planting a seed, mm-hmm. but I'm thinking maybe even this year. Why not enjoy the listener and the other listener and all their friends to an intimate event where everybody gets to share in this experience and have a nice little whiskey tasting?
That is something to consider. I will leave it in because I'd like to hear from our listeners about whether or not they think that's a thing. And depending on the feedback from our listeners and I guess fellow dipsomaniacs, that might be a thing. It sounds like fun. I would definitely do it.
Hey, if only you and I show up.
I mean,
still a great time.
So so then let us say this, the end of this year, we are going to have a review of the list.
Ah.
And if we can find it, a bottle of everything that's on the list, we will have a tasting of them all on that occasion.
It's a deal, sir.
Consider it done. Now, of course, depending on how long we choose to run together in this forum, this might become an annual thing.
I really hope that it does.
Or at the very least, a quarterly thing, maybe.
Oh, now, see, I was going to say, once a year seems about right.
Yeah, don't run out. Okay, I get you. Anyway, so this we talked about this offline a bit, but while we were sipping this single malt scotch, one of the things that I find fascinating about Balcones and the people like them, the distillers, is their passion for doing something in their local community. And it ties in really nicely with what I wanted to talk about this week, which is third spaces, or some people use the term third places. And I did some research as preparation for this conversation, because one of the things that is often true about our conversations is that they are opinion driven with factual underpinnings and data underpinnings, but we don't always cite our sources. And this time, or maybe, I'll say I don't always cite my source. This time I would like to put the conversation on a much more data-based footing, a data-driven footing, for the purpose of actually suggesting change in a real way in our community. And in a way that, number one, I think is necessary. Number two, in a way that I think is possible. And number three, in a way that I think will be something that we can buy conceptually, right? It's not realistic, for instance, to say that the Bahamas should have a lottery and we should tax every tourist and then every Bahamian should get a check with an even split of the proceeds from taxing every tourist who comes to the Bahamas every year. Now, whether or not that's possible, technically, whether or not that's feasible, logistically, all of those things are not relevant because there's no way in hell we'd do that. But I believe that with the right motivation, we can invest in third spaces. And my proposition is this. So the question is, the third space, is it relevant? And here's my proposition. The necessity of third spaces, that's neutral, informal gathering places that promote social interaction, has been well documented in modern society, both through sociological theory and empirical data. I would like for the first part of this conversation to take a look at some of the data and evidence that supports the importance of third spaces, so that when we get to the recommendations later, if we make any, when we get to the conclusions later, if we draw any, we are making recommendations and drawing conclusions based on commonly agreed data and evidentiary support. I have a caveat, though. No research on third spaces exists in the Bahamas. Not that I could find. And so for our sociologists, the Sunday Scotch Society issues this challenge. Do the damn research.
Are these sociologists at the University of the Bahamas?
Not only the University of the Bahamas, they are also, no doubt, at Bahamas Baptist University College.
University.
Right. They are also at Tarive University, or I believe,
University.
In Grand Bahama. Do the research. We will make sure it gets on the air, and not just on this show. Do the research. I dare you. I challenge you.
That is one of the things that makes a university, yes?
Research.
Specifically. I mean, I've heard that before.
Specifically. That is not, that you don't have to rely on whether or not that is word of mouth. That is, in fact, the definition of a university.
Okay.
So, yes, you are absolutely correct to...
So, research.
Yes, to stress that universities should be doing research. And on something like this, I think that it's not just the Bahamas that has a paucity of research on third spaces. It's the region, right? But we'll talk more about that as we go.
Okay, I hesitate to say this, but I am going to say that if you're going to endeavor to do the research, I will challenge you to make sure that it's damn good research. Because the past of the social sciences is not the brightest when it comes to science.
Okay. I'm gonna just let that marinate in the social consciousness of our listeners.
And that's a verifiable fact.
Boy, facts are dangerous things.
Well, you know, there's this little thing called reproducibility. Yeah, so the listener can have fun looking that up.
Okay. So to the university sociologists, do some research.
Some good research.
On the importance, relevance of third spaces in the Bahamas specifically. So first things first is definitions, right? The concept of third space refers to informal social environments outside of the home, which is considered the first space, and the workplace, which is considered the second space, where people can gather and engage with others in neutral communal settings. Third spaces.
Okay, like, so I just want to highlight that. That one makes it different to some of the social activities that you would, and the places where they occur, where it's leveling only for that particular group, mm-hmm. but it's not open to all.
Right, right. Yeah, neutral is, well, so.
Sorry, neutral.
No. Yeah. Third spaces like include places like cafes, libraries, parks.
Yeah.
They promote social interaction. They foster community engagement. They help build something called social capital, which we'll get into. But the concept of third spaces was popularized by sociologist Ray Oldenburg in his book, The Great Good Place. And in this book, he emphasized the importance of these spaces for strengthening community ties and for promoting civic life. So I did some digging, and the question of what makes a place a third space, mm-hmm. and this was what UNESCO suggested made something a third place. It's neutral ground, that is, you don't need an invitation, and anyone can enter. It's unstructured, that is, you can come and go as you please. It's not expensive. It's a place to talk, that is, conversation is the main activity, though playing games is also common. It's near your home or workplace. Ideally, you can walk to your third place.
Oh, and we're getting...
It has regulars, but strangers aren't out of place.
Right.
And chatter, joking, and teasing are an integral part of the third place.
Hold on, UNESCO said that.
Yes. In there,
that's super interesting to me.
Yeah, in the UNESCO Courier issued March of 2023. That's what they said.
Mm.
So I'm going to take all of that as our foundation and look at the data from our part of the world, and also some of it is from Europe, on social isolation and loneliness. So a 2020 report by the National Academies of Science, Engineering, and Medicine found that one-third of adults aged 45 and older feel lonely. And nearly one-fourth of adults aged 65 and older are socially isolated. Loneliness is associated with an increased risk of heart disease, stroke, and depression. Third places can help combat social isolation by providing environments that encourage face-to-face interaction and community engagement. A study published in the Journal of Urban Design and Mental Health linked third spaces to enhanced social well-being through fostering casual, spontaneous interactions that can reduce feelings of loneliness. On mental health and well-being, data shows that regular social interaction is linked to improved mental health. A study in the American Journal of Public Health found that people who regularly engaged in social interactions at public spaces like cafes, parks, or community centers had lower rates of depression and anxiety. Third spaces act as hubs for social engagement, contributing to mental well-being. This next one, I think, plays a... It loomed when I was reading it. It struck me as really relevant to us on the issue of stress relief.
Mm.
A study published in PLOS ONE found that individuals who visited green third places like parks and community gardens reported a significant reduction in stress. These spaces provide respite from the daily stresses of work and home life. For the record, PLOS One is a peer-reviewed, open-access mega journal published by the Public Library of Science since 2006. Just so you know where the research is coming from. I want to point out again that this study showed that people who visited green third spaces like parks and community gardens reported a significant reduction in stress, particularly stress from work and home life. I want to point out that stresses at home life were part of that research, and that the green spaces were a relief from that as well.
Yeah,
I don't know if you see why I feel like that particularly has some relevance for us.
I don't know if you're calling me blind, sir, but
no, I was transitioning out of my research mode and saying, if you, I feel like you may have some.
Yeah, well, I want to come back to green spaces in particular. There's a lot to be said there, and if our dear sociologists would invite a few ideas on particular things to include in their research, you know, I'm happy to.
Since we are the ones writing the research proposal, I mean, it's clear whatever you want to recommend should go into it.
No, I think this is, well, I really, really hope that some research is done here, because I think that not only would the outcomes, if we had better spaces like this, be very good, but from a bean counter / government budget point of view, I think the returns would be quite nice.
I believe so. I believe so. But the problem that we have in this regard is traditional, right? Is that we are speaking from a position of intuition, and bean counters need data.
Right. This is why this research is so important.
Yes,
I agree.
Exactly. Yes. Yeah. So on civic engagement and social capital is something I want to talk about too. So a study by sociologist Robert Putnam in Bowling Alone, which was published in 2000, demonstrated that third spaces are crucial to building social capital. And what social capital is, those are the networks and relationships that foster trust and cooperation within a community.
Yep.
Right. Communities with vibrant third spaces have stronger social bonds and higher levels of civic engagement. And with respect to fostering civic engagement, which I think is a... Well, I'll say that after I give this thing. In a 2019 report from the Knight Foundation, communities with well-utilized third spaces like libraries, parks, and cafes exhibit higher levels of civic engagement, volunteerism, and voting participation. These spaces allow people to exchange ideas, engage in discussions, and mobilize around local issues. Traditionally, voter turnout in Bahamian elections has been relatively high. This last election caused me great concern.
Oh yeah, I don't think the trend is going to change.
Because 46,000 plus FNMs chose not to vote. Not that they voted for the PLP, because the PLP only increased its voting count by about 9,000 votes over the previous election. So the PLP did not pick up any more voters. What happened in the last election was that the FNM lost 46,000 votes. And I don't care how irate you are at your party leader. I don't care how angry you are at the direction your party is taking. To abdicate your responsibility to engage in one of the most fundamental civic responsibilities is, it's terrifying only because this is the system that we have. Yes, we can, right. Yes, we can break it. Yes, we can change it, but we are not doing so.
Right. Well, so I was so vehemently against the idea of actively removing oneself, mm-hmm. simply because, although on the individual level, I am super fine with it, and actually, I'm not one of the 46,000 who didn't vote for the FNM, who would have voted for the FNM, because I always vote like
it, for the individual.
Yeah, which has zero impact. Let's be clear. And I know it has zero. I mean, in the past, it's been a variety, but at the aggregate level, this is super dangerous.
Yeah.
If it's done in a particular way, and the way it was done, i.e. there was no coordination, so you didn't get a positive result out of it. All you got was, in my view, a dangerous precedent to participation. And I think that, sure, the environment, the system that we have, not quite promotes this, but like, makes your options so few that, okay, I can understand it funneling people towards such a decision, right? But like you said, this is the system we have at the moment.
Mm-hmm.
And it's not going to change through these types of actions at the aggregate level.
Mm-hmm.
So I'm super concerned about that.
Yeah. And I think the fact that third spaces are shown through the research to have an impact or an influence on something like voter turnout really, I think, stresses and underlines the importance of these spaces,
mm-hmm.
especially to a country like the Bahamas, where you're small enough that a couple of people being upset about something can have a butterfly effect that leads to fundamental change.
Yeah, and that's a two-sided sword. So one of the things about third spaces that could be a problem is the regulars. So the regulars may not, like, in a good functioning third space, they won't exclude anyone, right? But personality types, and this is common knowledge inside of in corporate space, right? Where the so-called the introverts, and that's just one very, very kludgy, vague representation of a personality type, but they are less likely to engage in certain types of spaces, right? So that's a caveat for me, because sometimes I think that the problem, not the problem, but, you know, can be the sort of old man effect that you get, like, you know, dudes hanging out. Like, you know, it's their rights and whatever, right? But they hanging out in McDonald's in the morning or Starbucks or, you know, whatever the third space is, right? And they sort of, like, dominating it with their collective wisdom of knowing exactly what the problems are.
Ladies and gentlemen, you should see the quotation marks he placed around wisdom.
And, you know, I think their conversations are important, right? Mm-hmm. I just am concerned that they be balanced out with everyone else. You know, sometimes to join those conversations, you have to be quite aggressive, not in an attacking sort of way, but like really bolster up your energy and come in, and, you know, and I think it's important to especially expose our children to the need to develop the skills where, you know, you don't just shy away from from other people's opinions that you push back and you learn to play together, even though it might be get rough at times.
Yes, yes, and this is why,
right?
This is the function that the third space provides.
It is the field, though, yeah. Right? But to train the players, you need the other components like the coaching and the and the teams.
But they have to have a place to play, though.
Yeah. Oh, 110%. I'm behind you. I'm just like pointing out little things that would concern me, so that the thing works well. So for instance, there's some research, don't know if it's been replicated, on kids in schools on the playground. If the kids have they don't have older kids to tell them what to do or show them how to play, right?
Yes.
It's chaos.
Chaos, absolute chaos, yes.
But if there are some older kids who already have established ways of being and how the games are played and what the rules are and whatever, it's quite informal, but you know, it's a window into how culture works, right? And it just works like a nice little beehive. And we need that in the third space. We need people to like welcome you in and train you up into how to do battle on this field.
I don't know that we do need that in the third space, but I think that's what the third space is for. The third space is...
I think the culture does need that.
Well...
They need someone who... Because if the function...
Who is that? At a cultural level, who is that? I can see who it is in kindergarten. I can see who it is in primary school.
Mm-hmm.
But at a cultural level, who do you trust to train up a culture in how to behave?
Listen, it's not a matter of formalizing, but in the same way that there are regulars at the place, right? Some of the regulars need to, in my opinion, be open and actively like engaging others outside of the main little circle that always is there, right? And bringing other people in to the conversation and showing them how to engage or not engage. That's what I think.
Okay. I mean, I don't disagree. I don't even think you're wrong. I think you're right. I think that there is... That is one paradigm, and I think the third spaces are capable of supporting more than just the one paradigm. Because
for sure.
I think there are people who need that untrammeled, unfettered, let me do my own crazy thing. And I think those people end up doing extraordinary things. I mean, they could be extraordinarily bad things, but they can also be extraordinarily good things. So
yeah, and
I think there's room for both, is all I'm saying.
For sure, but and also different third spaces will serve different
for sure
functions, and I'm talking mainly about okay, just not letting the argumentation of opinions on how policy should work, etc., be too skewed in some particular direction by the regulars who shout down everybody else.
Some particular people.
Well, I mean,
and that's my quotation marks.
But I'm sure there are other places that other people dominate.
Yes, yes, there are. On economic and community development, this part I wanted to make sure that we talked about a bit too. Supporting local economies. A 2018 report by the Urban League Institute found that well-designed third spaces, like public markets, libraries...
Hold on. Did you say designed?
Public markets, libraries, pedestrian-friendly areas, Michael Foster, Pat Ramming, these people would definitely agree with the intervention that you made with that question. But these areas are linked to increased... local economic activity. Small businesses thrive in areas with popular third spaces because they attract foot traffic and foster community connections. Even more, research from the Kauffman Foundation suggests that co-working third spaces, like incubators and shared workspaces such as Crypto Isle, serve as hubs for entrepreneurs. Mm-hmm. And these spaces facilitate collaboration, creativity, and business growth, contributing to local innovation ecosystems. So, to me, it's self-evident. But it is also supported by data, supported by research, peer-reviewed research, that we need to invest in public markets, invest in libraries and pedestrian-friendly areas that have been well designed as third spaces for people in our communities. I want to put a pin in this and come back to this point mm-hmm. for a whole show.
Sure.
Because third spaces specifically as design projects,
yeah,
I think is a conversation that we should have with a design professional.
I mean, these are several conversations, and the question is, like, do you want to hit several professionals or have them on at the same time, or, you know, because we got to get an urban designer in here.
Yeah, for sure.
Can't exclude the architects, mm-hmm. but then there's also the people who sort of specialize in the reasons behind some of the design, more particularly like the third space and how that works. And
there's a study by the the Project for Public Spaces that found that well-designed third spaces contribute to public health by promoting walkability, providing yep. spaces for physical activity, uh-huh. and reducing urban stress. Cities with ample third spaces like parks and plazas report higher levels of physical activity among residents and lower rates of obesity and heart disease, two things that are killing behemoths.
For sure.
For the record, I just want to make sure we understand where the research is coming from. The Project for Public Spaces is a nonprofit based in New York dedicated to creating and sustaining public places that build communities.
Yeah, if I'm not mistaken, they have spent time here.
I'm pretty sure.
In the 2010s.
Mm-hmm. I'm pretty sure that I remember.
Or maybe even before that, actually. Yeah. I think it was the late noughties.
I'd have to double check, but I'm pretty sure that I remember that. There's a study, so I found these studies looking at third spaces. A study by Gale Architects highlighted that third spaces improve urban sustainability by fostering community participation in environmental stewardship and urban gardening initiatives. A lot of this, anyway, I was going to talk about urban renewal, but I'm going to leave that for another time. Third spaces have so many other... All right, so I'm going to speed through the rest of these. 2020 report by the Harvard Business Review highlighted the rising importance of third spaces like co-working spaces and cafes in a world where remote work is increasingly common. Third spaces offer an alternative to home offices and provide workers with social interaction, a change of environment, and creative stimulation. A survey by WeWork and Bright Spot Strategy.
It's independent of whether the work is actually good, but you know, it's a flag.
I'm saying that this was a survey by them, mm-hmm. not a study or a report. This is a survey which found that individuals who worked in third spaces like co-working environments reported higher job satisfaction and lower levels of burnout. Mm-hmm. We take that one with a grain of salt considering the source, but nonetheless, I thought it was worth representing mm-hmm. in this conversation. And the sort of the obvious milieu for third spaces is education and culture, right? Libraries are a classic example of third spaces that have been
let's talk about
to promote educational
libraries.
I spoke to Dorcas Bowler, who is the head of sort of the library division in the Ministry of Education. We're going to have her on the show to slice and dice this issue of libraries with us.
Is that where the main, I mean, the overall library agency, I forget
the
name.
Public libraries, yes.
Okay. So that is on the Ministry of Education. Mm-hmm. All right, all right, all right.
But an
important... Got some questions.
I'm sure you do. Get them ready. Miss Dorcas, she ain't scared. She ain't scared. So bring it with all the fire.
No, you don't have to worry about that. You bring her.
Oh, she'll be here. She'll be here. A report by the American Library Association found that public libraries provide critical resources and programs that support lifelong learning, particularly for marginalized populations who may lack access to formal education. When we get to libraries, like as a show or two shows or three shows, however long it takes, I have some things to say to the Bahamas. Because I studied for my BJCs and my GCE O levels at the Nassau Public Library on Shirley Street. I had a friend who went in there just a little while ago. Their most recent books in the library were from the late 1990s. It's now 2024.
Oh, you got them up to the 90s.
Yeah.
Sweet.
On the issue of cultural enhancement, cultural enrichment, sorry. Third spaces serve as venues for cultural activities, including book clubs, art exhibits, performances, those sorts of things. And a study by the United States National Endowment of the Arts found that arts engagement in third spaces fosters greater cultural appreciation and helps build a sense of belonging in diverse communities. We have a very diverse population. We refuse to accept that diversity in many ways, in my opinion, and I think we're weaker for it. But third spaces, I think, would provide an avenue, an arena, for us to engage with that diversity in spaces that do not feel combative and that do not generate feelings of concern, worry, fear, prejudice, those things that that overburden the diversity conversation and end up with racism, jingoism, xenophobia, these sorts of
things. General bigotry.
General bigotry, yes. So my conclusion from the research and the data that I was able to find on this is that third spaces are crucial for maintaining social connections, supporting mental health, fostering civic engagement, and boosting local economies. They play a vital role in modern society, offering a balance between digital and physical worlds, everywhere but in the Bahamas, right? And promoting inclusivity and creating spaces where people can engage, learn, and grow together. And forgive my snark, but I think the absence of these things in the Bahamas is one of the reasons we're doing this conversation. Because, anyway, the research from the Caribbean on the importance of third spaces highlights the crucial role these environments play in fostering community and social cohesion. One study that I found again in the UNESCO Courier shows that creating collaborative, decolonized third spaces can enable meaningful dialogue between diverse groups. I just feel like even though specific Caribbean studies and specific Bahamian studies on third spaces are either limited or don't exist, the broader global research and applications in similar social cultural contexts strongly suggests that third spaces are valuable for promoting inclusive community development and that the use of these spaces can help mitigate the effects of urbanization.
I am smiling so hard right now, man, because you felt so strongly about this.
That
was definitely something you wrote.
This last little bit was definitely written, absolutely.
That's awesome.
Because this, to me, is... You and I may not accept it in personal arenas, but Bahamians love celebrity. And the fact that we have a podcast is a form of platforming that I feel comes with access to people's spaces, right? Access to their digital spaces, access to their imaginations and their conversations and whatnot. Mm-hmm. And I feel like every once in a while, we should use this power for good.
So no whiskey next week?
Oh, I never say that. I never, not only did I not say that, I would not say that. Plus, whiskey is good. What are you talking about? Third spaces are a necessity. We do not have enough of them. The ones we do have are not properly protected, maintained, cared for, promoted. And I think that as a society, we are suffering from our under-prioritization, of third spaces. You are taking your final sips of the balcones now.
So good.
I am not going to lie, Matthew. I'm surprised.
At what?
That you like this so much, because I thought it would be a little strong for you.
It's not coming off like that at all. So
yes, that's cool. So the balcones, Texas, one single malt whiskey. If you find yourself in Texas, or you have a provider of spirits who is able to bring you this this wonderful opportunity to do so, go for it. They market themselves as the original Texas whiskey, which of course refers to the fact that they were the first people to do whiskey, single malt whiskey in Texas. I loved this dram, and I loved the conversation, Matthew. So have a wonderful week. Next week we'll pick up on third spaces and try to set a foundation for our conversation on libraries with Marcus and whoever else we bring to the table.
Yeah.
That's the road, my brother.
Ciao.